Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. My name's Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And my name's Jazza, and after listening to Sir Nick Clegg and Nigel Farage on Clegg's new podcast, I've realised that myself and Jimmy are just younger, somewhat sexier versions of them, except I have yet to become Deputy Prime Minister and find a Spanish spouse, and Jimmy doesn't work in the city in copper trading. Those are the only two differences.
I did used to cover commodities trading as a journalist.
Well, in which case, the only difference is me then. You are Nigel Farage, but younger.
Thank you. That's not at all insulting.
No, I don't think so.
Why do you insist on referring to him as Sir Nick Clegg?
Because it's the one win I've got out of the last 2 years.
Really?
I think so, yeah.
I mean, isn't... We've trod this path before, but isn't it odd that he managed to gain a knighthood when he appears to have accomplished almost nothing really of any, you know?
I feel like once you get to the level of Deputy Prime Minister, I feel like you're a shoo-in for some kind of a title, and I think that's fine.
Has John Prescott got a title?
Probably. Shall I Google it?
I don't know. He's the last... I think he was Deputy Prime Minister under New Labour, but I don't think every government has Deputy Prime Ministers. It was more because of the coalition thing.
Prescott is a baron.
Are you generally in favour of political has-beens being given, you know, baronetcies or knighthoods or what have you?
Yeah, some of them, when they've been Deputy Prime Minister. I'm 100% fine with that, because that's a big job. It's a relatively large job. Sir John Major, no, he was Prime Minister. Makes sense that he gets a knighthood. I think that makes sense. It's when somebody who has, like, slogged for about 20 years on some subcommittee that nobody cares about and has just licked the PM's arse for that amount of time, that's when I have issues with it.
But why do politicians need sort of like title recognition of having done a job? Isn't it enough to have done the job?
I mean, yeah, but we have this weird knighthood system in the UK. Why not give it to some nice people?
I mean, why give it to politicians if you want to give it to nice people?
I think we should have given it to Jade Goody. She was the people's princess.
Jade Goody?
Yep, Jade Goody from Big Brother. You remember
her. Is she the one that made the racist remark about her fellow contestant?
Yes.
Right. So you think a racist should get a title of some sort?
It's not like you to throw the term racist around so flippantly, Jimmy.
I mean, I don't think I need to repeat the remark.
It was a joke that's fallen flat. I obviously don't think that Jade Goody should have gotten a what's the female equivalent of a knighthood? Dameship?
Dameship, yeah, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
But hello, welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, where we talk about politics, social issues, and current events when we want.
Are we going with that now? We've given up on the weekly thing.
I think when we're very clearly not weekly, we should maybe drop that claim from the introduction.
You kept the pretense up for quite a long time, though. It's not been weekly for probably at least like a month, maybe two.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. It's mainly been my fault. I have this degree to do.
Students, eh?
I know, we're the worst.
Absolutely the worst.
What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
So we are starting off with the what's been called the Windrush scandal, which is the...
It's always a bloody scandal. Why can't it just be a mishap?
I think this qualifies as a scandal.
A scandalo.
And I mean, in the pantheon of scandals, this is an actual scandal rather than a mishap or a gaffe or any other kind of low grade problem or error.
I'm going to say I think it's disgusting. But anyway,
do you want to summarise what has happened since you think it's so disgusting?
Right. So there is something in the UK called the Windrush generation. These were specifically Caribbean, mainly Jamaican. People who were part of the British Empire immediately after World War II, they were encouraged and invited to come over to the UK to work in a variety of positions, from like healthcare all the way up to like construction, and to found their own businesses and all of that kind of stuff, to help rebuild the country after basically getting fucked over during World War II, to be completely honest. There were hundreds of thousands of people who came over, but the first boat that brought people to the United Kingdom, who were these types of immigrants, was called the Windrush.
It was called the Empire Windrush.
Is it called the Empire?
Yeah, it's part of a series of boats called, or ships, I presume it's ships, called the Empire series.
Great. Is it as good as the Star Trek series, or
ha 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 ha
lol? And so because this was quite a long time ago, the Windrush generation tended to have arrived between like the late 1940s, and people are kind of having the cutoff as like the early 1970s. And because of the manner in which they came, lots of their landing documents now don't exist. Now, this was put out quite eloquently by Stephen Bush from the New Statesman on their podcast. Because these people have been like of working age most of their lives, and when they arrived here, they've been working age, they haven't really come into contact with the state very much. And under the current kind of like desire to reduce emigration as much as possible under the current government,
immigration rather than emigration. Entering rather than leaving. Words.
Yes. To encourage people to leave the UK, essentially. They have these people are starting to retire and are starting to come into contact with the state again, and are starting to get sick and all of those kind of things as they get older. And a lot of them, or a handful of them, have been told that they're not British citizens, they're no longer allowed to live in the UK, and they should be deported back to their country of origin, even though a large number of them have never really, in any of their adult lives, lived in the Caribbean, where their families were originally from. And this has been seen as a very bad thing, because it's taken away some of the humanity of people who were encouraged to come to the United Kingdom and have been here for over 50 years.
Indeed. I feel like we've
But Jimmy doesn't think it's a big deal, so...
I didn't say that. I feel like you've fleshed it out to such... I don't actually know what we're going to discuss, because it seems so obviously wrong what's happened.
Oh, don't worry. I have bullet points.
Oh, okay. That's exciting. We should probably summarise the other two topics, because this intro has gone on for a little bit.
Oh, I apologise for being talkative on a podcast, of all things.
Right, okay. You're always telling me to, like, shut up so we can move on to the next point.
That's untrue.
All right, so in brief, the second topic that we are going to cover is the fact that... sort of two topics for one in this. You'll probably have heard, because the BBC will have doubtless sent you a useful notification on your phone, that the Royals have had another baby, specifically Kate and William, as I guess we're referring to them as, have had their third child, who is currently unnamed as we record this podcast. And
they haven't got the memo about trying to reduce population, right? Like, replace, don't create more children.
Clearly, I mean, the Royals are, you know, effectively German immigrants, aren't they? So,
sure.
And at the same time, there have been discussions about who's going to head up the Commonwealth. This episode is proving very Commonwealthy, actually. Prince Charles has been effectively rubber stamped, I think is a fair way of describing it, into...
Yeah, he's got a massive symbol on his forehead now where they did it.
Yeah, exactly. And he's going to be the head of the Commonwealth when Liz moves on to greener pastures.
When she dies. When she dies. Green pastures, what you think was a cow?
So we're just going to have another argument about the royal family, I think. So this is a totally contrived segment, but we'll just bring it back to a standard topic. What's the third thing we're going to talk about, Jazza?
So Sir Nick Clegg has a new podcast out called Anger Management or something. It's an odd podcast about anger. And so he's going around and interviewing a load of people who are angry. His first episode was with Nigel Farage, and God, it was a mess, wasn't it?
I thought it was okay.
Cool. Well, we're going to review that podcast and talk about whether or not we are just kind of younger reflections of those two very men.
Right, yeah. If you would like to contribute money to the Right Dishonourable podcast in order to pay for hosting costs and that sort of thing, you can go to patreon.com/rightdishonourable. We currently have 6 patrons we would like to thank. They are Ollie McGregor, Agatha Hoder, Gemma Cumming, Matt, Dominic Flood and John O. Thank you very much for supporting the podcast. So, Jazza, what do you make of the response to the Windrush scandal? It seems to have been pretty unified condemnation on most sides.
On all of the sides, including the Conservative Party, who are the reason this policy has come about. There was a really interesting kind of like thing happening in the Commons when Amber Rudd, who is the Home Secretary, and this wasn't her original policy of kind of like this. It's being called a hostile environment to immigrants in this country that was deliberately kind of like implemented in order to reduce the amount of immigration into the UK.
And it was implemented, the kind of hostile environment policy set was implemented under Theresa May, right?
It was. Who was in turn under David Cameron? So the Tories in government and still actually had this goal of reducing migration, immigration into the UK to the tens of thousands, not the hundreds of thousands, and they still have that goal, like 8 years since being in power. So that's going really well for them. This hostile environment that they talked about. Had like a few like main bullet points. It was one of them, which I think is the harshest, was to deport people first and then ask questions later, making the application process to reside in the UK more complicated, and then having tougher right to work and remain conditions for people who are looking to move to the United Kingdom. And so one of the things, especially for that last one, that was particularly consequential for a lot of people was that they made it so that if you had a spouse who was from outside of the European Union, you had to earn over £20,000, I think. So it meant that families were literally split up by UK government legislation. So that's fun. They deliberately created this kind of an environment that dehumanized people. And what we've seen quite weirdly is Amber Rudd, the current Home Secretary, who's kind of picked up the baton from Theresa May, really weirdly in the House of Commons blamed the civil service and blamed her department for not focusing on the individual enough. She said the Home Office has become too concerned with policy and strategy and sometimes loses sight of the individual. Mm. So it was meant to be that she was criticising her civil servants here, but it's her fucking policy. And I just felt like if I was in that room, I'd be screaming at her, being like, where's the mirror? You talking to yourself, love? Sick burn there.
I mean, if everyone agrees that this policy is terrible, why has it been allowed to sort of continue for so long?
Because they have this obsession with reducing migration, which actually isn't good for the country.
I mean, the people who want to bring down migration, they want to bring it down more for cultural reasons than economic ones, usually.
But the reason that they haven't been able to do this is not because of free movement from the European Union. It's because it's not viable for us to be able to do something like that. If we kicked out all of the immigrants, we'd have an NHS that wouldn't work, and we'd have public services that wouldn't work, because we rely on young workers from other countries to do an awful lot in this country. And then you end up having the toxic environment around immigration in this country makes me really sad, because there's no level-headedness about it. And people kind of end up, and I heard you talk about it in this way as well, Jimmy. Mm. People end up talking about it being about like cultural change, But this is a country that's seen quick shifts in cultural change before. The Windrush generation. Why can I not say that word? I can't say my R's properly. It's terrible. I should have practiced before we went on air. But the Windrush generation saw hundreds of thousands of people from the Caribbean move to the UK, and now they're being seen as integral parts of the United Kingdom that should be given the right to stay here. And as if that isn't possibly going to be the case for the large amounts of European immigrants who chose to make their lives here and have their children here and work and all of that kind of stuff. It's a really toxic environment that's made me really embarrassed, to be honest.
So I think the cultural point is more that some people kind of buy into, I think I'm more skeptical about migration than you, but I would include myself in this bracket. But like living in ethnically and culturally diverse cities and places, and they thrive off of that, and then some people don't. Because people make reference to the fact that people who are living in, or some studies have suggested people who live in kind of less diverse regions tended to be more likely to vote for Brexit and have more fears about migration, whereas people who live in...
Yeah, migration becomes a major issue for places that have the lowest migration.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually looked into those studies. I definitely know some people quibble them, but assuming that is true, I think it's kind of I see it as a legitimate preference to have in that sense. And there are also...
No, but that's a xenophobic preference. That is a preference based on people that you don't actually spend time with and you don't actually know. That is a xenophobic preference.
Maybe, but I guess if people want to vote for
people
parties...
People want to be xenophobic, then yeah, sure, they can be xenophobic, but call it xenophobia.
Okay.
Don't call it a debate over migration and a legitimate concern.
It still is a debate over migration, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yes.
I mean, this is the example I give. Japan infamously has very low levels of migration, although it has relatively large numbers of guest workers that come from East Asia to work there. Mm-hmm. And it's also very hard to get Japanese citizenship if you're foreign. I see that as a legitimate preference that they, or a legitimate policy that they have decided to pursue, that has some obvious economic drawbacks that you've already alluded to, and also to some degree has cultural drawbacks. But if a country wants to run its affairs in that way, I personally see that as legitimate. You know, whether you think that whether you think that's underpinned by xenophobia or not. The other thing that we're talking about is, this isn't quite the economic argument. It's more about the argument about sort of pressure on public services, which links into things around austerity and everything else, which I think is a valid concern, albeit one that can be mitigated with the right policies, if you see what I mean.
How do you think that that's a legitimate concern? Because this was something, I know we'll talk about this more later, but this was something that really annoyed me about the conversation between Farage and Clegg, was that Farage was allowed to make the claim that the stress on the NHS was caused by large numbers of people from Europe coming here and large numbers of immigrants coming here, where immigrants are... I mean, the phrase that they use is they're more likely to be serving you in the NHS than in front of you in the queue. And that's 100% true, because immigrants tend to be younger and they tend to be healthier. They tend not to need to use NHS services. The reason that we have a strained NHS is because we have an aging population that and a health service that isn't funded properly. Mm. It's not like the stress on the NHS caused by increased migration of mainly people under the age of 40 is not the cause of the NHS being strained at the moment.
I would agree with that, but if people do not want to sort of increase funding in proportion with the size of the population, or make the investment you need to, this is true whether you have a population boom due to migration or to higher birth rates. It's a logistical problem at the end of the day. Like that if you've got a population that's growing, you need to invest more in schools and hospitals and roads and all the rest of it. And if you're not doing that, yet yes, you, as I said before, you can deal with it. You can deal with it by making the right investments. But if people aren't willing to do that, mm-hmm. then having high migration does create strains on public services. I think.
But this has been one of the biggest. This has been one of the biggest problems with the Conservative austerity over the past 8 years. Is that there have we've been seeing the cracks in public services, be them schools or the or transport or the public health service, and it makes it easier for people who are anti. Migration, it makes it easier for them to make the claims that all of this is caused by those Poles who now have an aisle in your local Tesco. And that isn't the case. It's because we have been duped into not funding our public services properly, and that dishonesty makes me very angry, to be honest. Shall we go back to this Windrush thing?
Yeah, we probably should.
Can we talk about the political side of stuff? Because I find it, I feel like in any other situation, I think we're seeing this a lot with this particular government, with May's government since last year's election. Amber Rudd, in any other circumstance, would have had to leave her job, right?
Yes, I think so.
And that would have probably been the case for all of the other main positions in the cabinet, right? Like Philip Hammond has directly contradicted the Prime Minister on the future of the economy after Brexit as the Chancellor. We have the foreign, the head of the Foreign Office, Boris Johnson, flying around the world, like increasing the danger of British citizens.
And, yeah, I mean that is fair.
Insulting foreign dignitaries.
I shouldn't laugh, but that is true what you're saying.
Yeah, like doing not just a bad job, like actively making things worse. And then we have Amber Rudd, who has this slip up and has the audacity to blame her civil servants, who are there to implement her policies, which actually, at the end of the day, were Theresa May's policies.
I mean, is it a function though of a government that is, you know, focused on carrying out Brexit, or is it a function of a government that happens to be a minority in the House of Commons?
I think it's the particular. It's a bit of both, probably. Like they see it because they haven't got this. They haven't got a majority in the House of Commons. They need to not shake the boat as much as possible.
Yes.
And because of Brexit kind of looming in under a year, like it actually happens in under a year, anything that, like, if the government gets brought down, essentially, from a lot of people having to be shuffled around and being incompetent and then not voting with the government, then, like, Brexit gets derailed, essentially, doesn't it?
Possibly, yeah.
Or we just tumble out of the European Union and everything catches on fire then, I heard.
You seem to be massively worried about, you know, impending doom.
I'm going to be fine, Jimmy. I am a highly educated white man.
Let's not push it too far, mate.
I'm going to be fine. It's the rest of the bloody country that is going to be a mess.
Okay.
Do you agree with me do you think that it should have been Amber Rudd or Theresa May who'd have to have their head on the chopping block for this? Because technically this is Theresa May's policy being continued by Amber Rudd.
I think, I mean, that quite frequently governments just carry on policies that were implemented by their predecessors because it's easier to maintain the status quo than it is to change something. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I'd necessarily blame Amber Rudd for this, although I haven't looked into the exact history of the policy. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'd say yes, but then, like, it seems totally implausible that a prime minister would resign for a policy she enacted while serving in a cabinet role under a previous government without a rebellion in the House of Commons. So I mean, from a moral point of view, probably, but then, you know, politics isn't exactly about morality most of the time.
Do you think Amber Rudd is correct? Do you think that this is the civil servant's job for being inhumane in the policy, in the way that they are implementing the policy?
Well, I read, doing actual research for this podcast, I read an opinion piece in Civil Service World, which is a very exciting trade magazine / website.
Exciting.
And this is admittedly from Lucy Morton, who's a general secretary of the ISU, which is a trade union for migration staff.
A trade union, you say? They must be corrupted.
Well, you know, I'm just saying it's coming from a certain point of view. And she blames the stringency of the Home Office policy and the lack of discretion it's afforded border officials in implementing things and making decisions for the reason that all of these problems have arisen. So, and most of what this opinion piece says seems plausible to me, at least on a superficial basis. So I think it's far more likely that the problem came from Whitehall trying to bring migration numbers down than from the civil service. And this article also makes the point that these policies were implemented in at a time where budgets were being cut back, where almost all of the departments in Whitehall were trying to find savings here and there, and that actually experienced members of staff were made redundant so that they could hire cheaper, younger people and employ agency staff as well. So it seems like a confluence of all those factors, really.
Yeah, it's almost like austerity has consequences. How much do you think that we should spend on deporting a person, a singular person?
Single person?
Yeah, how much do you think we should spend?
I don't know, tenner?
Really?
I don't know what sort of question that is.
Well, like, do you remember those racist vans that were part of this hostile environment?
I don't think the vans were racist. I don't think they were a good idea necessarily either. But
you don't think that a lot of racist things are racist?
You think everything's racist?
Isn't it though?
I mean, if you don't think words, are useful having limits imposed upon them, then yeah, everything is racist. But if you think that the word and the concept of racism might be useful in some sense, then it is best to have some sort of limits on it. I'm aware I'm straying perilously close to like a borders metaphor here, but you see where I'm going.
So you remember those racist fans?
Right, okay.
So that campaign cost over £10,000. Do you know how many people
We should say to people who aren't aware of the quote racist fans,
talked about them a lot, though.
We talked with them with our Irish friends, but I don't know if we've actually covered it all that much. But anyway, there are vans with billboards on them that effectively said, if you're over here illegally, you should take yourself home, or you'll be deported. We have definitely talked about this before, but basically saying to somebody, if we don't catch you, you're free to stay, and if we do catch you, you'll get a free plane ride back to your home country doesn't seem that much of a inducement. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
how many people do you think left because of those racist fans?
Almost none.
Anecdotally,
I would guess.
It was 11.
11?
Yep. 11 people. So that's just over £1,000 a person, which I think actually, if you put that to somebody like Nigel Farage, he'd be down for just spending £1,000 and getting people out.
I'd have thought from a legal point of view, like, it would often cost £1,000 to send somebody home if you're including.
That's just
like,
for the campaign, though.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So that doesn't include like sort of legal costs and then the flight and yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so £1,000 in that context seems like a bargain, I guess.
Bargain, indeed.
Yeah.
Shall we move on to speaking of Brexit, maybe? I don't know. This is a very Brexit, Commonwealth, immigration-heavy episode.
It is.
Commonwealth Games happened. They were nice, weren't they?
Does anyone give a shit about boring sports like athletics?
I quite like watching the swimming.
Oh.
Mm? Yeah.
What's the appeal?
I used to do it. And so I'm just like, oh, I used to do that. How close is my time to that person? Very far away. Okay.
Hmm. Okay, but during the boring Commonwealth Games.
Yeah.
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 Where were you going with this?
Well, they happened, and then directly after the Commonwealth Games, we had that meeting with all of the Commonwealth nations. That's nice.
Right. What is the Commonwealth for, you know, people who don't know?
Well, the Commonwealth, that's how we are going to be a global outward-looking Britain after we leave the European single market.
Right.
They're basically... The Commonwealth, for anybody who doesn't know, are all of the nations that have Queen Elizabeth II as their head of state that also want to be part of the Commonwealth. It's made up exclusively of ex-colonial...
Not exclusively, ex-colonies. Actually.
Is it not?
No, there's some countries that weren't part of the British Empire that are part of the Commonwealth, and I don't actually think that all of the countries involved in it do have Elizabeth as their head of state either.
Oh, really?
I think it is mostly those, but I don't think it's all of them.
Interesting. Hmm. Well, I don't know what the Commonwealth is. Can you explain what it is then, Jimmy?
It's a loose intergovernmental body.
I think we're quickly identifying the problem with the Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth sort of just like hosts sort of international discussions, but it's not the UN. I think they booted out South Africa when people started objecting to the apartheid regime. I say that because for a long time Britain didn't really object to the apartheid regime. But so it did do that, and I think it promotes sort of a cooperation between the countries, but I get the impression,
and they have a mini Olympics,
right? Yeah, they do that. Yeah, yeah. They have a mini Olympics, but generally speaking, I think it's a bit of a talking shop. I don't get the impression it gets a great deal done. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you, but as we said at the start of this podcast, Prince Charles, who's the next in line for the throne when Lizzie pops her clogs, has now been effectively named as her successor to head up the Commonwealth.
Yeah, right. What is interesting about this is that it definitely doesn't necessarily mean the continuation of the monarchy as the head of state for a lot of Commonwealth members. Oh. So specifically, Australia are probably that. There's a lot of approval for Queen Elizabeth, but there is. They're probably going to hold a referendum as to whether or not they're going to continue to have a British monarch as their head of state. Hmm. And they probably won't vote for somebody like Charles.
Right. And a lot of Republicans think that Prince Charles will be good for the cause, as it were, when he actually, if he gets manages
to become
king.
He will be, inevitably. He's a nightmare.
Why is he a nightmare in your eyes, since you're a rabid monarchist?
Jimmy, I'm not a monarchist. I just quite like having the Queen around because I think she does a good job. If they stopped doing a good job, then I'd probably stop it, you know? I don't pick up Hello and read about Meghan Markle's, like, dress choices or anything.
Right. So your support is contingent on Elizabeth, really?
No, it's contingent on them doing a good job.
Right.
When they stop doing a good job, I'll join you on the Republican front.
Maybe we could have some sort of system where people get chosen for, like, set terms, and then they can be judged whether they're doing a good job, sort of on a regular basis through elections, that sort of thing.
No, the whole point is that it's continuity.
So, but if you got red, say that, you know, Charles comes in, he becomes king, and he does a really bad job, and through some crazy circumstances, we have another referendum, which I know you're very fond of.
Love democracy.
And we remove the monarchy. What would you replace it with then? If you're fond of the hereditary thing.
Well, I don't think that I think if Charles did a really bad job, then he should probably abdicate, and then we'll give Will and Kate a go.
Ah, so it's still going to stay within the Windsor family under your
skin. Yeah, I think so. I think we'd need an abdication, like with, what was his name? King Edward?
Yes.
King Harry? King Steve?
I think it was Edward.
Yeah, the one who abdicated and married an American. Ugh!
A divorced American at that.
I know. Absolutely.
Shocking.
Disgusting.
Scandalous. Yeah. And also had a lot of Nazi sympathies, which is embarrassing.
Yeah, but didn't everybody back then?
Yeah, quite a lot of people. Many people. Yeah, I've forgotten where we were going with this topic. But you're much more a fan of Will and Kate then, or Wills and Kate.
Well, yeah, no, but everybody is. This is no, there's nothing new about this. So why I find this particular the conversation around the Commonwealth quite interesting, is that I'm sorry to make this a very Brexit-heavy podcast, but there's a lot of talk of the future of the UK kind of existing in these pre-existing ties that we have with the Commonwealth. But I think you've highlighted quite effectively the problem with the Commonwealth, and we have, because it is it's a really loose alliance of a load of countries that used to be owned by the UK, and I don't think they particularly want to be treated like they're owned anymore. And that is a huge problem, I think, with a lot of the tone of the people who are suggesting a future that includes something like closer ties with the Commonwealth, because what they actually mean is for us to return to being able to go to South Africa and get them to give us their gold. Do they have gold in South Africa? I don't know.
Well, I think like long before we joined the EU, we had a trade system which was like governed by this idea of imperial preference, was the idea that you had sort of a free trade area within the empire, and then you had tariffs around the edge of the empire, although obviously it was heavily geared towards the benefit of Britain.
I think that was called colonialism.
Well, yeah, but just
Yep.
and then when we actually joined the European Economic Community, there was actually a lot of pushback from our former colonies, in the sense that, like Australia particularly, among others, because we'd actually still had good trading arrangements or preferential trading arrangements with them that we had to sever as part of joining the what later became the EU. So in a sense, it's a reversal of that. But most of the, I mean, Australia and New Zealand, for instance, are far more oriented towards East Asia now than they used to be. Partly because, as Nick Clegg makes the point in his anger management podcast, geography is very significant in trade.
Yeah, and that does make sense, right? I think it. So first of all, I don't think that there is really a desire for there to be for the UK to be given preferential treatment in places like Canada and Australia, and especially India. India gets talked about a lot, and India are very clear and have been very clear in the past what they want out of any kind of a trade agreement, and that is easier migration between India and the United Kingdom, and the United Kingdom is not willing to do that. And I don't think that it's like Canada and Australia and New Zealand all speak English. Lovely, wonderful. But they're very small economies. I think that Canada and Australia are in the G20, and India obviously is in the G20, but that's it really. And so in terms of opportunities, there aren't many, and it's also the geography thing, they're very far away.
Yes, that is true. Although, I mean, given given how heavy we are in terms of services and stuff, and like global services such as finance, I'm not, in certain respects, I don't think the geography thing is as significant, although it is in others.
Yeah,
I'm not
Jimmy,
disputing that.
two words, time zones.
The UK has an excellent time zone for international trading. That's one of the main
With
advantages of
Australia,
London.
it's 12 hours ahead.
Yeah, it's because we're one of the main links with Singapore in Europe, because we can sort of trade with New York in, is it the afternoon, in Singapore in the morning? Have I got that right?
Sure.
We do pretty well for time zones. It's one of the main areas. Are like London is a financial center, is that reason. So, but yes, should we move on to given, I mean, given we've basically just turned the Commonwealth thing into a Brexit thing, we can move
I'm sorry for doing that. I apologize.
smoothly into Nigel Farage versus Nick Clegg, who, as you said, like all failed politicians, has started his own podcast.
I think it's quite cute that they're doing that, because it's like they're coming into our territory, but being more popular, even though we do it better.
I'm not sure on the strength of this episode that holds true. But Ed Miliband previously did one, or is currently doing one, should say.
I think Ed Miliband's podcast is actually quite good.
Oh, I disagree. I listened to it once and I thought it was crap.
I think it goes into surface level concepts and encourages people to Google around it a little bit.
I'm okay with that. It's pretty dry.
So who do you think came out on top with this debate between Farage and Cleggy Weggy?
I think in the first part it was fairly even, but Clegg ultimately was more... I mean, I say this as a Leave voter, but I thought Clegg was ultimately more correct, because Nigel Farage... I feel like there's a certain intellectual honesty to Nick Clegg, where he will admit where people have points, whereas Farage, to a massive extent, doesn't admit it, that his opponents have
we'll
any points.
We'll just ignore
whatsoever.
Things. Oh, yeah. He's a fucking nightmare.
But in certain respects, I thought his remarks were quite cogent. And it was interesting. The first half of the podcast was kind of dedicated to just Nigel Farage's intellectual development, if that's not straining the word intellectual too much. But how his ideas about British sovereignty and the EU evolved over time, I thought was kind of interesting. His background as a commodities trader, and then his upset at the exchange rate mechanism, which pegged the value of the pound to the Deutschmark,
which is the nerdiest thing to kind of spark your political awakening, but also is never something I've ever heard him talk about.
No, I don't ever think he's mentioned. I mean, he must have said some crap about the euro over the years, surely.
Yeah, of course he has, but I've never heard him talk about kind of the exchange rate mechanism being the reason, being like the spark that he that caused him to want to leave the European Union. And I think that there's something really neither of us particularly like Nigel Farage, and I think there's something really disingenuous about him, because I think Nick Clegg incorrectly diagnoses him as a lover of chaos, but I think that Nigel Farage, rather than chaos, wants as little regulation as possible, so that people in his industry, in specifically commodities trading, can make as much money as possible so that it isn't regulated, and so that as little money is funneled into the state, and so people can basically do what they want. And I think that that's his goal, is so that people like him can get rich.
I think he's been called an arch Thatcherite in the past.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah, so in terms of like the deregulation agenda, that does appear to be one of the things. But I don't know, actually. I mean, he's been a politician far longer than he was ever a commodities trader. I don't know. Do you think that would keep you going all of those years? Just a desire to make your buddies rich? That doesn't seem very self-sustaining from an emotional point of view.
Well, there's the rumour that... do you remember on the day that Brexit happened? Oh, God.
Brexit hasn't happened yet, Jazza.
When the polls closed, he came out and said that he was expecting that he'd lost from the exit polls. And then... like the pound rose, and then it turned out that we ended up leaving the European Union. The pound dropped very significantly. There's talk that he did that. He used his public profile and an admission of loss so that his mates on the stock exchange could make a quick buck.
So you're basically accusing him of conspiring to insider trade, but with currency value.
I mean, I'm not going to accuse him of anything.
Market manipulation, I should say.
I'm not going to accuse him of anything. But I think that is a very strong reason for him to go into to start hating the European Union.
I think that's definitely part of his intellectual kind of background, isn't it? That's like him being a trader, his family being stockbrokers and traders of, you know, what different sorts of financial assets. That's where his like roots are, as it were.
Yeah, and I think that he was very happy to nail his colours to any mast that got that job done. That I think that he does believe in the UK sovereignty, even though he has this I think that the idea of independence is very flawed, because the United Kingdom, I argue, is independent, and is able to make the vast majority of its own laws.
Ultimately, you do have to admit this, in a legal sense, the European Court of Justice sits above our Supreme Court, and ultimately...
Yeah, but the thing, it's clashed very, very, very rarely with the United Kingdom, much less than any than other countries. And I don't really have a problem with... we've been clear about this. I have never really had any problems with the conclusions that the ECJ has come to and slapped the wrist of the United Kingdom government. I quite like the fact that the UK government gets held accountable.
Yeah, but I mean, it's accountable to a body that, you know, isn't really democratically accountable itself, or is only so through very convoluted mechanisms.
Yeah, but I think that the reason that I don't care about that a huge amount is because
you hate
the
democracy.
ECJ tends to align to my worldview.
That's kind of poor, though, isn't it? Like, I mean, even if you approved of every single piece of legislation that the European Commission produced, and even if you approved of every single court ruling from the European Court of Justice, the fact that it wasn't accountable to voters in, you know, the Czech Republic or France or Germany or Britain or whatever is an issue, isn't it?
But the ECJ is accountable. They get appointed by a panel made up of people appointed by governments.
Right, but the
and I and I
the,
actually,
the,
and I
the laws
and I
that the ECJ
want,
kind of I, adjudicates I, on behalf of, they're not democratically accountable in a meaningful way, are they?
Yeah, and I don't want my judges to be democratically accountable.
No, sorry, the laws that they're ruling around or on, or in relation to, are not written by people who are democratically accountable in a meaningful sense.
They are, so the you're talking about the commission, which are appointed by democratically elected governments.
Right, but you can't sack the commission. You can't vote for somebody. You can't, if you don't like what the European Commission's doing, there's no way to actually vote against them, is there?
I believe that there actually is, because you can vote your government out that would then appoint a new commissioner.
Right, but in terms of the kind of political culture and you could do that in theory, but actually in terms of how that factors into British debate and stuff, it doesn't really exist. Like, there's a theoretical way you could vote against the machinations of the EU, but in practice it's not really possible, is it?
I think that if we actually had before we ended up voting to leave the European Union, if we had a press that was willing to actually engage with European politics rather than write about bananas every other week, and we had an understanding of what commissioners actually did as a wider nation, then if there was, if people were dissatisfied with the way that a commissioner was conducting themselves and what they were putting through, which they don't put through on their own whims, by the way, they tend to put through and suggest things that are in line with the governments that we elect back home.
Somewhat.
Then perhaps we would be.
I think you're overstating things there.
How so?
Well, apart from anything else, it's an agent. What's the phrase? It's a problem between an agent and the person they're working on behalf of. Is that ultimately all institutions gain their own autonomy and gain their own way of thinking about things? So saying that. Yes, I mean, commissioners are appointed by the various governments, the governments of the 28 member states, but it's ultimately very diluted and very convoluted, and the lines of accountability, as I said, while they are theoretically there, in practice don't exist. And bemoaning the fact that, you know, the political culture isn't there to support the existence of that accountability is silly, in my opinion, because... If that isn't there, you can't conjure that out of thin air. That has to exist, basically. There has to be some inbuilt sense of legitimacy and interest and political discourse in order for that to work. And so, you know, complaining that isn't there
missing the
point.
The problem is that it was that political culture and the importance of it was ignored. And I agree that the European Union doesn't do a fantastic way of explaining itself, of communicating, or doing like citizen outreach a huge amount, which has caused a huge amount of the problems that we have in the European Union. But you can conjure political engagement out of stuff if you end up having actually a consensus in your local governments and in the journalists that cover these things, that the stuff that is happening in the commission and the people around there are actually important. And it wasn't seen as important, and it wasn't, and nobody endeavoured to actually understand the European Union until the UK voted to leave.
I mean, that's slightly unfair, though. People have been writing articles about the European Union. It's just that, you know, the interest from the readers, it wasn't there enough. And fundamentally, there was also just a cultural scepticism about the idea of the EU.
You see, this is the problem. People are idiots.
The problem is that you want to impose a political structure over people's heads against their wishes. That's the problem. Which is very Nick Clegg-esque, to bring us back to the start of this topic.
No, but Jimmy, that's exactly how every government has ever been created. No government has been built from the bottom up.
Yeah, not entirely, but you know, we have actually reached a stage of maturity in the West where democracies don't need to be kind of overrided in that way. I mean,
hold on. So name me a single nation that's actually been able to do this. And like, so there was obviously the Icelandic attempt to crowdsource a constitution in like 2013, but that ended up failing. It's never actually been passed. And so no, there's still every legislation, every kind of like founding document of a nation and every kind of like structure of a government has been created by a small political elite. Whether you're talking about Spain transitioning from dictatorship to democracy, or whether you're talking about the UK slowly moving from a monarchical to a constitutional monarchy, that's always the case. And I think that criticizing the European Union specifically for being like that is really disingenuous when every political system is like that.
I mean, it's not disingenuous to say that there was no compelling reason to sort of form a new government over the heads of, say, you know, French, German and Italian people when they already had governments that existed and provided, you know, governance for the peoples that they represented. You know, it's new in the sense that you had elites from different countries coming together and saying that they would form an eventual union by increments, like slowly over a very long period of time, you know, without directly consulting the citizens that they were supposed to represent. That is new. I mean, the other thing you said about elites always being responsible for forming the exact architecture of government, that's true. That is always how it happens, but I think the EU is unique in that respect, I've just highlighted.
Interesting. I think that you do have a
you could
point
say
there,
maybe
the
UN, I guess, or like NATO, perhaps. So there are other treaty organisations that you could compare it to.
The United States existed very much like that as well. Like many states, there was a lot of pushback, especially in places like California and Texas. There was pushback when they initially joined the Union. People didn't want to.
I mean, there was also pushback between the states when the Constitutional Convention was ongoing, which I know you know about because we've talked about Hamilton previously.
Hamilton.
But I think that, you know, they effectively ended up coming together, you know, largely out of fears of foreign interference from the various European empires was probably the most significant. That's probably a bit strong. One of the most significant driving factors in that, whereas, as I said, I don't think there was a compelling reason to actually bring, or like, certainly not for Britain to join the EEC. But that's an aside. I think it is a different argument, although some of the things you've mentioned are true for, you know, different countries at different periods of their history.
Cool. Shall we wrap this up? We ended up not talking about Clegg and Farage very much.
Well, do you want to like give? Did you think it was a successful podcast? Do you think that Clegg should produce more of them?
No. I do love him. It just kind of confirmed what a nasty piece of work Farage is, and I don't use that lightly. I'm not just throwing stones. I just don't think he's a very nice person. Sorry. What?
What do you mean he's not a nice person? Do you think he's motivated by unpleasant instincts or aims or whatever.
There was one particular quote that just made me go, it made me vocally just say, "Oh, fuck off," while I was walking home today. And he talks about the fact that there was one nation that lost World War II, and it was us. That's when our big imperial possessions began to disappear. Our big imperial possessions, ladies and gentlemen, are countries that sought independence from us from when we colonized them. And I think that that really summarizes his worldview of, like, Rule Britannia, the great and mighty. That doesn't fit in a multipolar world. I don't want to go back to colonialism.
Mm.
And he does.
I mean, some very cynical people would argue that the European Union was itself a form of colonialism.
Jimmy, fuck off. No.
You know, the continuation of Greater Germany by other means has also been a label that has been applied to the EU previously. But again, by other people, not me.
You're the worst.
You're just very satisfied to wind up. Where can people find you on Twitter if they want to wind you up directly?
You can find me at JazzaJohn. Please be nice.
You can find me at JDE Nichols as well.
Don't be nice to him.
Don't be nice to me.
Bully.
And you can also find The Right Dishonourable at Right Dishonour, or you can go to rightdishonourable.com.
Oh, we had a lovely review was really genuine from Twitter, right?
We did, yes.
Give me a Jimmy, cut this out.
I've got it in front of me. Do you want me to read
it
out?
Okay, yeah. Excellent. No editing needed.
No,
do you want to read it out? Because I really want to hear you cringe at the sincerity.
Okay. This is from Dan O'Hara on Twitter, who says, at JD Nichols, at Jezza John, "I have to say, stumbling onto your podcast was like finding gold. Was never engaged with politics or current affairs till I discovered you guys. Just want to say thank you and keep doing a great job."
Isn't that the most beautiful and sincere thing that you've ever heard?
I think I was trying to avoid a sarcastic response, but I was almost like, are you lost? Like, this is Twitter, you're not supposed to be. And I think he's from England as well, so, like, you know.
This is not the place to be nice. What is wrong with
nice
you?
Nice and sincere.
Please, and if we too have changed your life, Please do let us know, because apparently our egos fucking love it.
Yeah, you know, it's nice when people say nice things about you on Twitter or iTunes, even, where you can leave a review.
Yeah, that helps us a lot, actually. Yes. If you could leave us a review on iTunes, that means that we go up the rankings. Although we're a very old podcast now, and that's probably never going to happen.
Whoa.
Is
there some sort of, like, age thing on in terms of rankings then?
I don't know. No one knows how Apple works.
Probably not even Apple at this stage.
No, wee. All right, toodaloo then.
All right, bye-bye.